All right, let's move out to the wide receivers, and I think there are a lot of interesting storylines among this group. I think a couple years ago, when the big recruit, when the big receiver recruiting class came in, everybody got pretty excited about that position. And you know, I'm actually going to start with one of the guys who's not a starter right now, but I think is maybe the most interesting storyline heading into camp, is Laquan Williams, who we all remember for making that fantastic catch against Rutgers 2 years back, and was hurt last year, only had I think two catches, something like that, and. But now he's back and getting some high praise from the rest of the guys.
Yeah, this was one guy that both Chris Turner and Ralph Regan mentioned as, you know, obviously hurt for most of the season and the entire spring. So kind of people kind of forget him, forget about him, as there are about like nine other receivers who could play this year. He's a guy that actually could go to the forefront, could be end up a very integral part of the wide receiver core, just because he's one of those big time playmakers. Obviously could catch the ball in almost any situation, as you saw the catch with Rutgers, as you mentioned, 2 years ago. And, you know, he's one of those guys. I mean, there's no certainty as to who will emerge from this just logjam at every position. You say Torrey Smith is safe and probably Ronnie Tyler is safe, but you don't know what else you're going to get in terms of who's going to be on the field and what situations. I mean, but Laquan Williams is definitely one guy that I think could be the one who kind of rises the most during fall camp, assuming he's back full strength and all that.
Clearly, he's a Chris Turner favorite, in part because of that Rutgers play. And Chris went at length to describe how much better that Laquan has looked in 7-on-7 work this summer, not necessarily giving him the ringing endorsement of health or anything, but at the same time, you know, that there's those foot injuries, you know, have a way of, you know, at least psychologically lingering a little bit. I mean, I can remember watching the JV game that Laquan played in last year, and there was a dropped pass or something like that, and one of the parents on the sideline was like, well, who was that? Somebody said it was Laquan Williams. It's like, that doesn't seem like our Laquan or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a guy that clearly Maryland could use, and a guy that Maryland would certainly welcome back if he is going to be as effective as he was as sort of a change of pace guy a couple years ago.
Torrey Smith, probably the safest guy, you know, wide receiver, returning kicks. He's looked good in the spring. He's a guy people are very excited about. You know, not quite the speed that Hayward Bay had, but he's got a lot of the same qualities in that he's a bigger guy. He's got good hands, or I think he probably has better hands than Hayward Bay has. He's just more of a, you know, he's just an all-around pretty good wide receiver. Ronnie Tyler, I think, is a perfect guy just to have an Okendo-type year, get those third-down catches. He'll certainly be a target. He's, you know, he had a huge catch in the North Carolina game. Yeah. To continue that game-winning drive. The other position, the other wideout position, who does that have starting there? I forgot.
Tony Logan.
Right, Tony now. Logan. I mean, that's one's pretty much up for grabs. They like Logan's speed and kind of his ability to kind of scoot or get around people. But at the same time, I mean, even behind Torrey Smith too, and it might shake out differently. You know, guys go from one end to the other, as that always happens. But you have to look at guys like Quentin McCree. He had a big spring culminating in the 3 touchdowns in the spring game. You look at Imani Leodai, who had another good spring. Kevin Dorsey is a guy that everybody is high on, and people say could be the next great wide receiver. And, you know, judging by how he conducts himself, I think that's fair to say he is a very good shot combined with his talent. It'll be interesting to see if anybody actually comes to the forefront at that point, or is it just going to be kind of rotating carousel.
You didn't even get into Adrian Cannon, who Chris Turner was also very high on heading into this season. And I think Cannon's a guy that spent a lot of time studying with Darius Hayward Bay last season. Another really bright guy. So you got him, you got Dorsey. Obviously, no shortage of options here. And this isn't a situation where if you just have 3 of them, that means you have none of them. I mean, they have 8 of them, and it means they have 8 of them. I don't know if any of them are necessarily quite as innately talented as a Hayward Bay, but there's a lot of good options here. And so, to me, I think at the end of the day, the guys that are early on, the guys that are able to run routes correctly, especially short routes, if that offensive line doesn't hold up, are going to be the guys that emerge quickly as the reliable targets. Now, going down the road, if the line holds up better, then maybe speed and things like that play a bigger role. But I think that for now, you know, the guys that are smart and know how to run routes correctly are going to have a big leg up really heading into the first month of the season.
Well, with the eight guys in the rotation, I mean, could we possibly see all of them getting a shot at, you know, some significant playing time somewhere over the course of the season?
I think by the end of the season, every one of those guys will have a catch and will have played a role in some particular game.
I'll go out on a limb and say of all those guys that we've talked about Smith, Cannon, Leo Dye, we've talked about Logan and Tyler and Dorsey and Laquan Williams, and I think I'm missing one other person.
Quentin McCree.
All of them will have at least five receptions barring injury at the end of the season. I would also not be shocked if none of them have more than 35 receptions. I mean, that just might be the upside for this group. I mean, Torrey Smith is the one guy in there that I think might have a chance to go beyond that. But I think that it's going to be a very, very balanced, eclectic group this season.
How much would you value depth over experience right now?
You know, this kind of came up when people talk about the loss of Hayward Bay. Is that, you know, and Chris Turner has mentioned this too, whether it be in the spring. I think he mentioned it last weekend. But are they better off this year? You know, they lost a first-round draft pick. But are they better off because all these guys come back with a year more experience, and you know, a couple guys showed some stuff last year, and it's kind of more wide open. Chris Turner seems to think that they're better off this year, and you know what? I wouldn't necessarily argue with that.
As a unit, I think they might be. I don't think that they're better off exclusively because Hayward Bay is wearing silver and black right now. Assuming that he signed today. So. You know, I think that one of the interesting things with this group is that unlike last year when you knew Hayward Bay was going to draw a lot of attention, who do you pay attention to here? Again, it always comes back to saying, assuming the offensive line holds up. I mean, I sound like a parrot. But the reality is that if the offensive line holds up, who do you pay attention to? Do you put extra attention on Torrey Smith, or do you kind of, you know, play it honest? And so I think that's something that Maryland really has going for it. I mean, a lot of this comes down to the idea, a concept that's more prevalent in basketball, but it's significant in football too, that I think is overrated, and that's the go-to guy. You know, you can have a lot of guys that you can go to. That's the better situation rather than having one obvious thing. I mean, this isn't Tecmo Bowl. You know, you can't just give it to Bo and have him run around everybody all the time. So, you know, The reality is that I think that you look at all those options, and if some of them do emerge, if three or four of them do emerge, Maryland will be better off with its wideouts than it was last year.
You're listening to the inaugural edition of Inside NB Sports Radio, along with Seth Hoffman. I'm Mike Brody. We're joined by Washington Times writer Patrick Stevens. You check out his discourse blog at the Washington Times website, WashingtonTimes.com. Is it WashTimes.com?
Washington Times.
Washington Times. Okay. We've been talking a lot about the receivers. Let's talk about the guy who's going to be throwing the ball to them, Chris Turner, who I believe enters a season as the most starts at quarterback in the Ralph Regan era going into a season.
Going into a season, that sounds about right. Mm-hmm.
You just put up the quarterback breakdown today on the blog, so you got the numbers fresh in your head. What were some of those that you were talking about earlier about his place in the record books?
Let's assume that Chris Turner precisely replicates his junior season this year. He will finish on Maryland's career list first in passing attempts, second in completions, second in passing yards, and fourth in passing touchdowns. He'd be behind Milanovic in completions and passing yards, and would be behind Scott Milanovic, Boomer Esiason, and Scott McBrien, interestingly enough, in passing touchdowns. And so you have to start thinking, you know, where does Chris Turner rate in terms of Maryland quarterbacks overall? Obviously, different eras, maybe more reliant on a run game, things like that, maybe more a greater aggregation of talent with guys like Frank Reich, Stan Gelbaugh, Esiason, and all in that stretch in the 80s. But Turner has a chance, if he just has a similar season to last year, of having his name rather prominently listed on Maryland's career lists, which of course will no longer be in media guides to be printed out, but it'll be in some list somewhere. So,
is this a year? I mean, Turner has always been a guy who's been kind of wildly inconsistent. And you wrote about this, you know, wildly is maybe a little too harsh, but he's been inconsistent from game to game or from, you know, ranked team to non-ranked team. And you wrote about this as your story at the first day of ACC Media Day about, you know, is this a year that he kind of becomes more even along the whole plane, maybe not have a fantastic game or no terrible games, obviously the fantastic games they won't argue with, but just be more, you know, even along the entirety of the season.
You know, I thought that he was really on pace to do that in the middle of last year. You remember that NC State game where there wasn't anything terribly spectacular about it, but every pass he threw, even in the muck that day, there was no way an NC State guy was going to catch any of it. And of course, you get to the Virginia Tech game, which was not very good. The Florida State game, which I think we can agree might be his worst performance as a starter. Up there with the Middle Tennessee game, I think. So I'm inclined to think that there will be a little bit more consistency. I don't think you're going to magically flip a switch and all of a sudden, Chris Turner has become Sam Bradford or Colt McCoy or somebody like that. I mean, that just isn't going to happen. But I think that he can be, you know, you can be a step above, you know, a caretaker type quarterback, which is basically all that Ralph Regan has asked his quarterbacks to be pretty much since he got there. I mean, some have done better than others, but Sean Hill was a handoff machine as much as anything else. Scott McBrien, you even head into Sam Hollenbach, and remember Hollenbach having like a 7-for-9 day against NC State his senior year. I think Turner absolutely has a chance to be more consistent. I don't know if necessarily he's a guy that is going to be ultra consistent week in and week out, but I think that he's a guy that 10 games out of 12, you're going to be pretty happy with what you get out of him.
It'll be interesting to see if just knowing that he's the unquestioned starter from start to finish this season, you know, but of course, barring injury, will do anything for him mentally. You know, the interesting thing about him is he's not a guy that you could say, you know, this affects him. So he just seems like he's just such a cool customer, or just, you know, he's so even keeled. Even though when Jordan Steffi was named the starter, I mean, he nearly transferred because obviously that was a big blow, you know, if he wasn't going to end up playing or not. But then he came to the rational decision, you know, over the course of a 12-game season, chances are this quarterback's going to get hurt, or chances are something's going to happen, and he'll be able to step in. But he's never struck me as somebody who's overtaken in any sense by emotion.
He is not a psychologically fragile guy. I don't think that's the case in the slightest. And so, you know, I think the question, you know, about this time last year when that quarterback decision came down wasn't so much, you know, can he recover for it? It was, you know, does he want to stick around and deal with this after really, I think a lot of people, I think it's fair to say a lot of people thought that he didn't necessarily get the fair end of a fair shake in that situation. I don't think necessarily anyone in the program thinks that, and I'm not necessarily advocating that myself, but I know that a lot of fans were very upset when that decision was made. The reality is that it is his job, and I don't think that it's really going to affect him that much, but you bring up a really interesting point. I wanted to get into it. Is that simply guys do not hold up for full seasons at quarterback very often. Part of the entry today, you look over the last six seasons, Maryland has had the same guy play the majority of every game at quarterback only once in the last 6 years, and that was Sam Hollenbach in 2006. You look back to 2003, you had the Scott McBrien concussion where Joel Statham came in a 7-3 loss at Georgia Tech. The 2004 season was its own mess. In 2005, Hollenbach barely played in the Florida State game, and they needed to call on Statham. In 2007 and 2008, Steffi starts the season, Turner finishes it. So, you know, it's a little ghoulish to be sitting here saying, all right, well, odds are Chris Turner's going to get hurt somehow. But it's not an easy position to play, and with those offensive line questions, you know, there's the parrot again, you know, offensive line, you know, it's a situation where you have to think, well, you better be keeping an eye on what's going on behind Turner, simply because there's a chance that he won't be able to play 12 or 13 games or 14 games, as Maryland would tell you. despite how durable he has been so far in his career.
This is now the ninth season, or we're entering the ninth season of the Ralph Regan era. How does this unit, since we now cover all the positions, how does this unit stack up against some of the, we've seen a lot of strong offenses, a lot of somewhat weak offenses. How does this unit fit into all those?
Let's kind of take that a step further and say, would there be a comparison? Is that something kind of you're getting
at? Yeah, well, yeah, I guess there's a lot more unknowns.
Right. Is there a comparison 1 year out of the Ralph Regan, now entering his ninth year? Is there 1 year that kind of sticks out? My initial thought would be it's similar in a sense to 2004 in that the defense looks stronger. But, of course, you have a quarterback who started so many games, and the offense looks far more promising this year than it did in 2004. But so that doesn't really fit that well. But is there a year, do you think, that this year resembles at all?
My vote goes to 2006. You've got the senior quarterback who has had a fair bit of experience. You've got a couple tailbacks that have played. You've got some younger receivers that are in that mix. The offensive line isn't necessarily that sure a thing. I think they were probably a little further along with that group, a guy like a Crummy, but they, you know, Edwin Williams was being broken in that season. You had Jared Gaither, wherever the heck he was with that bunch. So I think on offense, there's some similarities there. Even, you know, you look at them breaking in a coordinator. I think more and more we're going to see the offense have James Franklin's stamp on it than necessarily Ralph's stamp on it, just the further along you go. And then you look over on defense, that was, you know, there's some similarities there. It was a first-year defensive coordinator that year. And so there's maybe a little bit of excitement, you know, having something a little bit different. And I would say that you could look at that group and say that the strengths were similar. You know, you had Josh Wilson as a senior on that bunch, you know, so you had obviously a very good cornerback to work with, and the safeties were certainly okay enough with Christian Varner coming to mind there. The linebackers were a solid crew, and there were some questions on the defensive line. I think that's probably the most comparable team. That was a team that got very fortunate, to be perfectly honest, you know, scored just as many points as its opponents and went 9-4. I mean, there's something that doesn't quite stack up about that. So I would say that's the team that this one kind of reminds me of, and I think that was a team that I would have picked to go 7-5 or so in the preseason. So I don't think that's too far off what people are going to say about this team either.
That said, 06 was, I think everybody agrees, as you said, a very fortunate year considering they were outgained in most games.
I think it was 11-12 regular season.
Yeah, outgained in most games, about scored the same amount of points as their opponents. Won several games, by less than, what was it?
Touchdown.
Yeah. I mean,
like five games by 13 points,
right,
or something.
It was a very, very lucky season. I don't want to say lucky, but a very fortunate season that they had. Would you say, you said you had them preseason about 7-5. This year, would you go with that same kind of prediction, 7-5, 6-6 type? Do you think that's safe for that season? I have my own idea. I just want to get Mike, your thoughts, and Patrick, your thoughts on that. What you see as a reasonable expectation for this team, and what maybe you see the max is, considering if they're fortunate, and what you see the worst case scenario being.
I think 7-5 and 6-6 is about right. If that line comes together, then you're looking at a ceiling of about 9. Maybe if they get really fortunate, 10 games. But I would say that anything beyond 9 victories would be surprising, and even that's pushing it. If the line is terrible, then we could have a rerun of 2004, and you're looking at a very real possibility of a 4-8 type season. Simply because if the offense is only putting up 10 points a game, well, it's kind of hard to win very many games that way. What I will say is this: even if the line is terrible, Maryland will win one game that it has absolutely no business on paper winning, because that's what they always do.
Exactly.
I mean, even in 04, they beat Florida State, which was a top 5 team at the time. So I think that regardless of that development, there will be at least one game that people will be able to look back on and remember very fondly from this season, just simply because that has been the Terps' MO under Friedgen.
And the beauty of playing in the ACC is that you know, you're going to have a shot to win, you know, a large number of these games, since there's not really a ton of elite teams in the conference. And, you know, you, just kind of going down the schedule here, I don't like predicting the games, but I'm going to do it because that's my best analysis. James Madison, Middle Tennessee State, Rutgers, those should be wins at home. Rutgers may be a wild card in there, but you should get three wins out of that. And you know, you look at Duke, you know, Duke could be a bowl team this year.
Well, what do you think about Cal?
I skipped over Cal. Oh, I was trying to pick up the wins first.
Okay.
Those three wins, the Duke game is a game they should win right now, you would think. The Boston College game at home is a game they should win right now. And then other than that, Virginia at home, they should win that. Other than those, I don't think you can say that there's a game that they should necessarily win. There's other games that they definitely can win. But I'd say right now that there's six games I would favor them in. So I'll say seven wins. Because like Patrick said, they'll probably pick off one of these games that they'd be an underdog in.
You know, I feel like this is sports talk radio and I have to disagree about something. But I don't think I could say anything different than 7-5 with a standard deviation of one game either way. I think, you know, that's not much of a prediction. You know, that's like 3 out of 12 possible, you know, outcomes. So I've covered a fourth of my...
The difference between going 8-4 and 6-6 could be, you know, the difference between going to Florida for a bowl game and going out west again for a bowl game. Mm-hmm. It's a big difference.
Right. I think the key stretch right here is after your first five games, after your Cal game and the four games at home, at Wake Forest, Virginia, at Duke, three of, you know... You look at the preseason poll, maybe it doesn't shake out that way. But I think those are three very winnable games that Maryland has that will pretty much be able to tell you with the final four games remaining if this is a bowl team, what kind of bowl team this is, and just how the season will shake out. Because if you figure they go 3-2, which is realistic expectation over the first five games, figure a loss to, say, Clemson, Cal. If they kind of go 2-1 the next two games, you're looking at 5-3. You're looking at most likely a bowl. If they go, you know, 2-1. If they go 1-2, you're looking at 4-4, and you have to win. Virginia Tech is at home, and then you have to go on the road to NC State and Florida State, what I think are two of the better teams in the Atlantic Division. So then, at that point, it becomes very tough to get the six wins. Either way you cut it. So I think that stretch, that three-game stretch right there in the middle of the season, assuming they kind of shake out at 3-2 to begin the season, that will determine, you know, how far and where bowl they get to.
I think that that's pretty reasonable. I think one thing to take into account is exactly where on the schedule that they get certain teams. They will go down to Duke with Duke coming off its bye week. That is a very, very nasty situation. They will go down to NC State coming off their bye week and have played very well against NC State over the last few years. I think that that's an opportunity for them to be able to poach one of those November games. But I don't think there's any question that you better go into November with five wins. You do not want to have to face that gauntlet in the final month of the season with those trips to NC State and Florida State, having Boston College, which could very easily be playing for its bowl life at that point as well, playing Virginia Tech, who they just simply have not played well against in the slightest since they joined the ACC. You don't want to have to get an even split of that. But if they are 5-3 or even better 6-2, then you're going to have all these high hopes about, you know, even, you know, still talking about ACC titles and things like that, which is, you know, pretty much an every other year type occurrence in College Park. So this would be the other year. But at the same time, I think that we'll know quite a bit about these guys, even by the end of September, and surely by the end of October. This isn't like a couple years ago where you knew they were going to go 3-1 and get blasted in Morgantown, mm-hmm. and sure enough, that's exactly what happened. And you're sitting there waiting for conference play to start. It's like, well, who are these guys? I think we're gonna have an answer to that pretty quickly.
All right, well, we're starting to talk about some of the other ACC teams here. We'll save our big ACC preview for a little bit later. Probably towards the end of August. But right now, we'll get into some overarching themes that we see in the ACC this year. First, quarterback resurgence. We have a lot of returning starters at quarterback, a lot of names. Russell Wilson, TJ Yates at UNC, Chris Turner. a lot of guys that you've heard of before. Is the ACC a strong quarterback conference this year?
You know what? I think it has to be stronger than last year. You know, that's not saying much. But with the guys returning, if you want to start with the, you know, start going north to south, Chris Turner is one, Tyrod Taylor is another, even though, you know, he didn't start last year. They actually planned to redshirt him, but he ended up taking over when they realized Sean Glennon is, you know, well, Sean Glennon. And then you have TJ Yates at UNC, Russell Wilson, who I think could become the best quarterback in the conference just because, you know, he's such an athletic, you know, just really, really great athlete back there. And his baseball genius have given him a strong arm as well. Riley Skinner at Wake Forest, nobody really, you know, kind of talks about him as being one of the better quarterbacks in this conference over the last decade if you look at his entire body of work. You know, Clemson's breaking a new quarterback. Georgia Tech, you know, it's not so much about the quarterback there, but Josh Nesbitt has done really well in their system. Christian Ponder at Florida State, maybe he's finally the guy to break out of the Florida State quarterback malaise the last, you know, few years.
8 years. Post Chris Wenke,
yes. And that has contributed significantly to their downfall. And then Ja'Cory Harris at Miami, a fairly new name to the scene after Robert Marv transfers, and somebody who they're looking to save the program or at least bring it back to respectability. Do you think this year, Patrick, is kind of the year that the ACC, behind its quarterback play in particular, kind of rises up to being, you know, have more teams kind of in the national scene?
I think there's certainly the possibility, and I want to put in a plug for Thaddeus Lewis at Duke.
Of course, how did I forget?
Beyond Wilson might just be the best quarterback in the ACC.
I can't believe I forgot him.
The problem is, you know, he plays for Duke. but Lewis is really good, and I'm really looking forward to the chance to seeing him October 24th down in Durham. But back to your point, I think some of it is going to come down to not having instability. You look last year, Virginia Tech switched quarterbacks early in the season. NC State, Wilson gets hurt, and you go through the Harrison Beck era version 2.0 and the Daniel Evans era version 3.0 and 3.1. TJ Yates gets hurt and Cam Sexton comes in. Virginia has its mess. You look at Clemson with them calling for Cullen Harper's head. The three-headed quarterback at Florida State, the two-headed quarterback at Miami, Steffi and Turner, and Dominique Davis and Chris Crane. I mean, you look everywhere. There's no stability in this league. That's the key. If they can have some stability beyond simply Thaddeus Lewis and Riley Skinner, which is, I think, pretty much the only spots where there was a sort of wire-to-wire situation in the league last year, I think that the ACC will be better off. Is this a group that is suddenly going to remind you of the Big 12 circa 2008? No, it's not happening. There's not any of those guys are going to be on that level with Bradford, McCoy, even Robert Griffin at Baylor, Harrell, obviously. I mean, we can keep going on the quarterback list from the Big 12 for a very long time. But assuming there is stability, and assuming that you're only down to a couple schools that are making switches in the first few weeks or even in the first half of the season, then naturally the quarterback play is going to be better and that the offenses are going to look better this season.
Let's move on to, I don't know if you can say that there is necessarily a national contender. Let's put it this way. Is it healthy for the ACC to have a national contender? I mean, Virginia Tech really is the only team that stands out to you this year as a national contender. There's certainly a lot of parity and excitement within the league and certainly a lot of divisional competition. We saw last year, the divisions were up for grabs for eight teams in the final 2 weeks. But, you know, obviously on a national stage, not a whole lot of people care about that. Is that good for the league?
John Swofford mentioned two things in his annual address to the media in the ACC kickoff at Greensboro. First off, he said, you know, 10 bowl teams from the ACC, you know, it's a record number. That's great for the conference as a whole. But in the next breath, he said, you know, he acknowledged that the lack of a national title contender has hurt the ACC's reputation as a national power and a conference that people talk about. And of course, the record in their BCS games, you know, Virginia Tech was the only winner last year against Cincinnati in, what is that, in the 2000s, am I right?
Mm-hmm.
That was the only winner?
It had been since the Florida State national title team that they won.
Right. Yeah. So those two things combined, you know, that they haven't had a national contender lately, and even the teams that have won the ACC have not done well in their Orange Bowls or BCS Bowls, those two things have hurt the league. I'm not sold on Virginia Tech being a national title contender. We'll know more after the first weekend if they're really you know, in the picture, depending on that Alabama game. I think they have too many questions, you know, with Taylor, if they could be able to throw the ball. But I think they're the closest thing, you know, well, Clemson was a lot of talk last year, but when you look at Virginia Tech as a program, they're not going to slide like Clemson did. They'll always have their 9-10 wins type season. If they could get past that first kind of game and beat Alabama, then you have to seriously put them in the picture. And I think that, for the league, at least gives it a little more talk on the national scene.
Couple points here. First off, Virginia Tech's a national contender with a caveat that the forward pass is eliminated. Okay. Second of all, Alabama is going to dash those national title hopes in the first week of the season. Third, having a national title contender is undeniably an important thing for the ACC. Let's run through the rankings of the 8 teams that have played for the ACC title since they went to the divisional format in 2005. In 05, it was 5th-ranked Virginia Tech against unranked Florida State, and Florida State. It was 16th-ranked Wake Forest and 23rd-ranked Georgia Tech in 06, with Wake winning. It was,
and that was arguably the worst championship game you could actually ask.
It was like 5 field goals, right?
It was 9-6 in the rain in Jacksonville, where no one cared. 6th-ranked Virginia Tech and 12th-ranked Boston College in 07. And then last year, unranked Virginia Tech and 18th-ranked Boston College in Tampa. I was at the 07 game in Jacksonville, and I saw a lot more teal seats than I did burgundy or maroon or whatever color you want to toss out there for the two teams that actually had fans there. And from what I understand, I didn't actually watch the game last year. I was covering Army-Navy, but apparently it was substantially worse in Tampa last season with the same two teams. So, you know, no one cared about those things. I mean, I think that maybe the first game was a legitimate success. The last three have not been. And that's reflective of people just not caring about the ACC. So you get a top five team, a team that's still in it going into the final 2 weeks of the season, that if they win their next couple games, they might be playing for a national title. That's going to do wonders for the league, because otherwise it's just simply the land of 8-4 teams with 10-2 Virginia Tech tossed in there for fun.
And of course, you know, the ACC title game moves to prime time, but nobody's going to watch it if it's a Virginia Tech.
And it's going up against the Big 12 title game. I mean, let's be serious here. I mean, you're an average national fan. If there's no national title implications, what are you going to watch? Are you going to watch Bradford or McCoy, or are you going to watch the ACC game? I mean, I know what I'd watch.
But you bring up an interesting point, because we are approaching a potential transition as far as the ACC television deal, with, you know, the ACC not having as many, I guess, primetime games right now. They are moving that game back to 8 o'clock this year, and it hasn't been 8 o'clock since the first year. What is the current, you guys heard it from John Swoffer last week, what is the current deal, or it expires after this year, and what did he say about going forward?
Well, basically, both the football and the basketball contracts for the league, which they've typically negotiated separately, are up after the next school year, the 2010-11 year. And so, clearly, with the SEC having gotten its mega deal from ESPN, I believe that was earlier this year, perhaps it was late last year. Basically, that's kind of set the bar substantially higher than it was previously in college sports. Now, we've talked about the ACC not necessarily having the best overall brand of football in terms of elite-level competition. From top to bottom, it's good. But without those national title contenders, how do you expect people to pay more money? Well, the subtle inference by mentioning basketball and football saying, well, we might be willing to negotiate them together is, well, the ACC basketball brand remains as strong as it's ever been. North Carolina coming off its national title and lots of big names in the sport, even some of the bad schools or the bad programs in the conference, places like NC State, Georgia Tech was at the bottom last year, Virginia. Those all have some sort of name brand working for them. So there's a chance that the ACC is going to be able to leverage that and get more money for its football rights as well and do it in tandem rather than do it separately. But for now, Swofford basically is saying he's happy with the rights holders, and they will certainly give the current rights holders the chance to negotiate first, since that would be their contractual right.
I mean, I don't have much more to add to that. And I will say, though, as much as I enjoy a Doc Walker, Steve Martin, who else is
Mike
there?
Mike Hogwood.
Mike Hogwood games. Raycom is not, what is it? It's still Raycom now?
Mm-hmm.
It does not remain my favorite broadcasting outlet. And
someone doesn't like noon kickoff.
And they'll have to explore alternative options, like you said. You know, he didn't say it outright. John Swofford, that is. Obviously, we're dealing with our current partners, such and such. You know, the political type statements. But there's actually a sports, sports journal. What is it called? The Sports Business Journal article about how maybe the ACC is looking into joining other conferences for a network type thing. We'll see if that is considered. But in wake of the SEC's $1 billion deal or whatever, obviously the ACC has to make some sort of move in its new contract, whether it's, leveraging the basketball rights to improve football or joining a kind of a Big Ten network for a combined set. But we'll see. And I think those right there, you look at quarterbacks, running backs, the TV situation, and the national contender, I think those are probably the four strongest storylines you have going in the ACC in the 2009 season.
And I think you're right on that. And that will wrap up our first a long episode. This is our career high in length for Inside. Well, it is the first episode of Inside NBC Sports.
You set the bar high.
Yeah. In franchise history. We'll say franchise history for the radio program. And we thank Patrick very much for coming on. Remember to go to his blog, Discourse. That's D1 Discourse at WashingtonTimes.com. And we'll be talking to Patrick throughout the season, so this is not the last that you'll hear from him. And what we got on tap for next week?
I think next week we'll kind of review the basketball recruiting live period that just will end on Friday, July 31st, whenever this goes online, whether it be today or tomorrow, whenever we put this up online. But it ends the July 31st, and that's it until the season starts. And so we'll review that, where Maryland's coaches have been. We'll hopefully talk to Terrell Stoglin over the phone. He's been playing in several places this fall, and we'll ask him the Maryland point guard commitment, obviously, for 2010. We hope to get him on the show, and we'll kind of break down some of that. And training camp for Maryland opens August 10th, which is it the Monday?
Monday.
So well, I guess we could touch, if anything, breaks between now and then. But next week, I think we'll have a little more basketball show and maybe kind of look at the basketball schedule. I know that's always something you would
enjoy. When we are and Patrick, you do a good job of trying to
hunt down the basketball season. We're approaching the we're almost got it set. How many non-conference games do you think we have left that have not been reported? It's somewhere?
Three or four somewhere. I mean, I think obviously you see the Indiana game, the Villanova game, the three Maui games, which that should come out sometime soon. The last couple of years, Maui Invitational was unveiled its bracket the first week of August, so it wouldn't be shocked if that's out there. The trip to UNC Greensboro set. And then there's a handful of other games from various spots that have been reported. Haven't necessarily seen those officially released, but there's certainly a fair number of schools that we have a pretty good idea are coming to Comcast Center next season. So I think there's about three or four of those types of games left. Wouldn't be surprised if there's a local team, maybe a random Patriot League team or two. They've done a very good job of picking off teams about one every league or so in the general geographic area. So it wouldn't be a surprise if there is a Patriot League.
So that's something to look forward to, and we'll start discussing it next week. So.
And depending how football goes, basketball talk could start quite early in these parts. So not that it doesn't ever.
I don't know if anybody would be particularly upset with that, though.
No, and this is one of those years that people will be quite excited about how that shakes out. And basketball's not that far away, to be honest. What is it, October 15th?
Two and a half months.
It's not too far.
All right, for Patrick Stevens, Seth Hoffman, I'm Mike Brody. We will see you next week.